The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. Listen on demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Now available free for both iPhone and Android devices.
Jim Bullard, president of the St. Louis Fed since 2008. Today is the Homer Jones Memorial Lecture. Glenn Hubbard, former head of the Council of Economic Advisors, will be delivering that lecture later today. And we are so honored to be invited back a second year to do our show, sort of helping you commemorate this event. Jim, welcome.
Well, thanks so much for coming, Kathleen. Thanks for being here for the Homer Jones Lecture. We're really looking forward to a good lecture later today.
And I want to remind everybody that you can, it's going to stream live at stlouisfed.org/live. Is that correct?
Yeah.
4 o'clock Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you can, everybody around the world, figure out the rest of your time zones. So, Jim, you know, I mean, a couple big picture questions I want to ask you, but let's start with Homer Jones because his spirit is here. Homer Jones, what he means to the St. Louis Fed and kind of what he means to you. I know that almost sounds kind of corny, but still, in terms of what you have tried to guide on monetary policy, what is the legacy of Homer Jones and how is it being expressed today?
Homer Jones is best known as being Milton Friedman's teacher. Friedman and Jones were at Rutgers at the same time. Friedman was an undergraduate and Homer Jones was on faculty. This is late 20s and early 30s. And if you read Friedman's reminiscence about it, he says that Homer influenced him to, you know, pursue further studies in economics as opposed to mathematics or statistics. And so everything kind of evolved from there. They remained friends for many years after that. Homer Jones came here in 1958 and, you know, ultimately revolutionized the way the Fed approached economic analysis and research and let that flow into monetary policy. And a lot of that all started with Homer Jones. So we really appreciate his legacy, and that's why we have a lecture named after him.
We were talking, Steve Matthews, who's also here, Bloomberg Fed reporter extraordinaire here in the room as we have this conversation about an interview. Do you remember October 2009? And the NABE event was here, and we taped the interview, and we played it later on the show. And I remember so clearly, because at the time I kept saying to people, you know what Jim Bullard just said? I think it makes so much sense. The Fed started doing these bond purchases, this quantitative easing, and he said, you know, we don't know how long we're going to do this. And if that's the case, we've got to, like, formulate it. We've got to figure it out. We've got to treat it more like the way we treat the funds rate. We raise it when this happens, we cut it when that happens. It took the Fed a long time, 3 years, but they've come around to your view, it seems.
Well, I do think the committee in general has come around more to that view than they were originally, and so I appreciate that. And, you know, the chairman at the last press conference did say that we would try to adjust the pace of purchases in response to economic conditions. So that's very much what I was saying in 2009. So, you know, I felt that our best policy tool once we hit zero on the policy rate was going to be, you know, the quantitative easing type activity, and that you should try to moderate or expand that activity in response to economic data. You can't just be saying that we're not going to react to data. That wouldn't be good policy. So I think we've made a lot of progress on that, and I appreciate where the committee's come out on that.
Jim, can I ask you how much in agreement you are with the Fed's current stance as it appears in the statements after the FOMC meetings? Would you say 50%, 60%?
Well, what would it mean to say 60%?
Well, it would mean that there was 40% of you that didn't agree with it, but not enough for a dissent.
Oh, I thought that it would mean 40% or 60% as much purchases or something like that. I would say generally that the stance of policy is appropriate at this time. I think even though I'm an inflation hawk, I mean, if you look at inflation, it's pretty low right now, 1.3% measured year over year on PC inflation. That's not a big number. I think that'll turn around this year, and I think it'll head higher, more back toward target, but we're going to have to get some data on that and see that. So right now, I think the Fed has room to maneuver on this with this policy.
Tapering. You were the first one to sort of say that publicly. Tapering off on bond purchases. Was that the first step in that direction? And we, you know, is that the point where the FOMC was starting to realize that this was the way to go?
Well, I think tapering would be, you know, a word that would describe what I was also describing in 2009, which is that you should react a little bit to economic data. You take small victories when they come in. So if you get some better data on the economy, then you could adjust your tool a little bit. That would be a way to acknowledge to markets that we see the better data coming in, and it shows that we're going to adjust our policy
a
little bit in response to that. And that would be the analog of the funds rate tool, in which we would make very small moves. I don't know if you remember, you know, a lot of people have forgotten the funds rate era, but when you make a 25 basis point move, then a lot of people in markets would say, well, that can't possibly matter. It's only 25 basis points. But it's a way to signal. It's a way for the committee to signal we've seen better data or worse data, and it might indicate a whole path of future policy, and that's why it has larger effects than it would appear.
Quick question. Do you have a number in mind? What tapering is tapering? $10 billion a month, 15, 20?
Well, I would be very comfortable with moving in small amounts, moving more often in small amounts, 10 or 15 billion at a time. And I would like to get the committee to be willing to move in those kind of increments. But so far, we haven't done that.
Haven't gotten that far. But hey, it's just,
I think we're much closer than we were on that. Yeah.
Because certainly at the last press conference, the chairman, Ben Bernanke, formalize something that Jim has been talking about for some time, that in an era where there is a zero interest rate, the lower bound has been hit, the zero bound, as people call it, how do you make a difference in policy? What is your instrument? Clear now from what Ben Bernanke said, the path the FOMC has taken, that the bond purchases, the quantitative easing, this has become the new policy instrument, or at least that's what we're discussing with Jim right now. We have a lot we want to talk about, the economy, inflation, and more. I want to ask you another specific question, though, Jim, about the latest FOMC meeting in March. Was there a level of asset purchases that you urged? Did you favor slowing the purchases a bit, $80 billion? I guess they're $85 billion now, or was it not yet the right time?
It's $85 billion right now, and I was comfortable with that for this meeting. I don't think we have to be in any hurry because, as I cited the inflation numbers, they're pretty low right now. So we have time to let the economy pick up here, I think, in 2013, and we'll see how things evolve through the year. So the other thing I'd want to say about current policy is the policy as it stands today has really only been in place since December of last year. So we really
December of 2012.
Yes, because that's when we got rid of Operation Twist, which I think has been less effective, and then replaced that with open-ended purchases. So combined with the decision at the September meeting, it's only really since December that we've had what I would call something that looks like QE2 did. And I think QE2 was effective. So we went through a long period where we were mostly doing twist-type exercises, and I think that was probably less effective than these open purchases that we have now.
President Bullard, there's been a lot of talk of sustainability from Fed officials lately. What do you mean in particular by sustainability? What will show us that the expansion is sustainable?
Well, I think we've been getting some good numbers on the jobs front. Today we had ADP. I think if you average over the last 6 months, we're close to 200,000 on ADP. We'll see what tomorrow's report brings. But I would say that the news on the labor market has been encouraging. But you'd like to see that continue and like to make sure that we're not going to have a spring swoon the way we've had in the last couple of years. I do think global uncertainty is much lower today than it was a year ago. That's probably helping the U.S. economy quite a bit. And so I think things are pretty good right now for the U.S. economy, but we'd like to see more data roll in.
Well, and of course, the tracking estimates for first quarter GDP, a couple big, you know, Wall Street firms have raised their forecast to 3.8%. That's almost 4%. Some have gone from low twos to almost to three.
Yeah, when we started the quarter, a lot of them were below two.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it shows you something about the forecasting world. there's a lot of uncertainty. They have a tough job. But the surprise has been to the upside in the first quarter. I find that very encouraging. I think that the year as a whole will be over 3%, so I think it will be strong, and or at least strong compared to what we've had in previous years. So I think we're in good shape right now.
clearly inflation isn't a cost right now of QE. So what is? A lot of talk as well about keeping an eye on the costs. Why not full steam ahead if inflation isn't one of those costs?
I think that's exactly what the committee's doing. It's full steam ahead right now.
What about inflation expectations? And of course, as we get into the theoretical side of the Fed's policy now, and it seems to me a lot of it is based on theory. Again, the role of expectations, Michael Woodford's work. I want to take the inflation expectations part, because if you look at anything, if you look at the break evens, if you look at Treasury securities versus inflation or tips, you say, oh, it doesn't look bad, except for one thing. The Federal Reserve, many say, has completely distorted the yield curve. It's impossible to know what the real signal is from the bond market right now with the Fed buying so much of the supply. So how can you be confident that you're reading inflation expectations appropriately?
The nominal yield curve has been affected, but the tips market is a place where those that want to make bets on a lot of future inflation could do so if they wish to. And we don't seem to see a lot of inflation expectations building up there. It has been up, maybe slightly over the last few months or quarters, but there certainly has not been a big move there. Now, one thing I would say about that is you don't really want to wait till you see a big move in inflation expectations, because it might be too late by the time you get to that. So I am attuned to this, and we do watch it very closely. But the truth is, actual inflation has been running below target. And why is that? Well, you've got Europe in recession, and you've got a global situation that's not as robust as it was during the QE2 period. The QE2 period, you saw inflation sort of roar back and go up above 2%, at least on headline inflation, during the QE2 period. But that hasn't happened this
year. Is this essentially an inflation-targeted, or at least inflation-based policy? As long as inflation stays low, you can sit back and say, hey, we can just keep buying bonds 80 to 85
billion. I wouldn't say it's just an inflation-based policy, but the committee certainly has more comfort in a situation where, with a very aggressive policy the way we have it now, in a situation where inflation's low. If inflation was above target, then you'd have a real question, a real decision on your hands, and right now we're not there.
President Bullard, I'd like to ask you about unemployment. There's been a huge number of people who have dropped out of the labor force. So what does that suggest to you about the labor market? How much structural unemployment are we seeing?
Yeah, labor force participation has trended down. Some of that's population demographics, but some of it has been in excess of the population movements. If you look at that trend line since 2000, it's been going down over a decade or 12 years here. So that's one thing that's been occurring. But on top of that, there's been additional withdrawal from the labor force. Now, I'm still predicting that unemployment will continue to come down through the year here, as it has over the last 3 years. Even the last 3 years have been a period of lackluster growth, but we still saw declines in the unemployment rate. And I think we'll still see that in 2013 here, where I'm expecting faster growth. So we might even see faster reduction in the unemployment rate. I do not expect people that have dropped out of the labor force to come back in. I think you would have to get to much lower levels of the unemployment rate to entice them to come back in on the basis that it's a very robust labor market. We saw that during the 1990s when unemployment got down in 4% range. Then you really did have people coming in off the sidelines.
When you look, the question we asked people, Vonnie and I, on the show, off the show, well, we're going to be up with Jim Bullard. What should we ask him? And several people said, what is the Fed watching when they're trying to decide whether or not it's time to even start tapering off on the bond purchases, on quantitative easing? What are the indicators?
Well, as you know, on the policy rate, we've offered these thresholds, and I think that's been a good way to get rid of the date guidance on the policy rate and get toward a more state contingent policy for the policy rate. But on the QE, we have not been able to get a consensus around any kind of thresholds or anything like that, and I don't think we'll be able to. I think it's just, it's more controversial, just harder to get agreement on that. And so I guess we won't be offering that. So what we have right now is that we're looking for sustained improvement in labor markets, and we are getting better labor market data. But like I say, I think we have we can afford to be patient here. We can afford to let more data come in during the spring and see what happens.
Well, there's that old saying, you know pornography when you see it. Do you know sustained labor market improvement when you see it? You know,
the thing about the labor market is, of course, you know, the headline unemployment rate is, of course, important, but there are many other aspects to the labor market that are also important. You've got hours worked, and as we've already talked about, labor force participation. Not to mention non-farm payroll employment, which is typically considered your most reliable indicator of macroeconomic performance in the short run.
At what point, Jim, will we know if we've avoided a spring swoon, though?
We're going to just have to see how the spring develops here. I know a lot of people are talking about that as a possibility, but, you know, that's almost a seasonal argument. I don't think it's a good argument just because it's true that it happened the last couple of years, but that's probably not a good reason to think that it would happen again this year. Also, I think one of the main things that happened in 2011, 2012 was that the European sovereign debt crisis, which was much hotter at that point than it is right now. And so if, to the extent the European sovereign debt crisis continues to stay more or less on hold, at least with respect to possible contagion, financial contagion to the U.S., if that stays at a low level, that probability stays at a relatively low level, then I think we'll be in great shape here in the U.S. Europe is in recession. And, of course, that's not good. And the prospects for Europe may be growing faster, are not as good as the Europeans would like them to be. But from our perspective, the main risk was that there'd be some sort of major financial catastrophe that would come over to the U.S. And I think the probability of that is lower right now than it's been in the last 2 years. So that should help us. I think one thing about the calmer situation in Europe is that right now I'm thinking this can continue through the German elections in the fall. So if that's the case, that will help us a lot.
Sequestration. The fiscal cliff hasn't really been hit because the cuts don't come through till later in the year. But isn't it interesting that some of the spending numbers haven't looked that bad? The shock of a lack of confidence maybe hasn't materialized. What kind of impact is the $85 billion sequestration going to have on the economy?
I don't think the impact will be as large as others have talked about. I would put it on the low side. One thing is, when you cut spending out, yes, that's less government spending, but that's also less tax revenue that you have to raise at some point in the future. No one talks about that side of it. So if you said, instead of saying it's an $85 billion sequester, it's an $85 billion tax cut, people would be talking very differently about it. So I don't think you'll see as big an effect as people often talk about.
So what does that mean for unemployment? You said you see unemployment coming down over the course of the year. What kind of unemployment rate could we see by the end of the year, particularly if sequestration doesn't derail the labor market?
In the last 3 years, unemployment has come down about 0.2 per quarter. Those were years which are not great growth years. So with a little bit faster growth, you could see unemployment getting down to 7% by the end of the year, even below 7%. So we'll see if that's really what materializes. You know, economy is hard to predict and you never know. But I'm encouraged about where we are right now.
Charles Evans, though, said yesterday, the Chicago Fed president, that in about 2 years we're still going to be missing on the employment objective. Do you agree?
In 2 years we're going to be missing
the employment objective, yeah.
According to my projection, we would be getting very close to 6% by the time we get 2 years out. This would be the fourth quarter now of 2014. And my natural rate or long-run rate of unemployment is about 6%. So I'd say we'd be very close at that point.
I mean, in the past, we always talked about the long lags in monetary policy, right? If the Fed cut or raised interest rates, it would take, 6 months or more for that to really play out. So how is the Fed thinking about lags now? If you have thresholds instead of triggers or, you know, if you're coming down to your threshold, do you wait till you hit it, or do you say, oh, we're heading the right direction? I mean, I think this seems one of the tricky parts for me. trying to figure out how to calibrate, how to be ahead of the curve so you don't overshoot on inflation, right? Or even stop too soon and undershoot on unemployment. But once the momentum's there, how do you gauge it?
No, it's a fair point, and that is the history of the Fed, is to try to, you know, it's a big ship, and you have to turn the ship before, you have to be thinking ahead a little bit about where things are happening. So I am concerned about, we are watching that, but that certainly has not been the problem the last couple of years. So, but that will, that issue, I think, will come back to the fore now as the economy continues to pick up, is you know, how long do you want to let more rapid expansion continue, even without seeing inflation, before you might think about making a move, and the committee will have to wrestle with that. But let's face it, in the last couple of years, that's not really been the case. It's gone the other way.
And I guess it'd be a nice thing to have to wrestle with, wouldn't it? Indeed.
Yeah.
You know, one thing we really haven't gotten into, Jim, I think is also a really important part of the debate right now. You're having a discussion at the Fed. It's clear that people are raising different issues. And, you know, here's how I look at it. The Fed has a dual mandate. It's got price stability and it's got employment. But it seems to me there's another mandate, and that is not creating financial instability, trying to create financial stability. And this is one of the big questions right now about the bond purchases and the balance sheet, and it's getting really big, right? And how you're going to get out of it, et cetera. So there's a lot of things here, but let's start with this question of what you're watching in the financial markets. Jeremy Stein, relatively new Fed governor, I thought made the most interesting comment, arguing for maybe moving that key rate off zero earlier than many others would like to, saying, in so many words, maybe we need to kind of flush out those corners of the financial markets where there might be excess speculation building that we can't quite see. You know, the Fed misread, like a lot of people did, the bubble, housing bubble in the mid-2000s. Does Jeremy Stein have a point?
Yeah, you know, Governor Stein gave that speech here in St. Louis at a conference that we had here maybe 6 or 8 weeks ago, and I think it was an important speech. You know, his famous phrase, or what will become a famous phrase, I think, that monetary policy gets in all the cracks of the financial system. That's a good point. And that was a way to push back, I think, against a little bit against the what I would call the Bernanke doctrine, which is that we're going to respond to excesses in financial markets by using macroprudential policy. We're going to use regulatory or other channels in order to fight those tendencies, and we're going to use monetary policy for macroeconomic stabilization. So, you know, I think it was very interesting. He's very good at, you know, he's well known as a financial market economist, and is certainly a force to be reckoned with. So I think it was an important speech.
Well, sir, what are you watching? What do you see? Are you sanguine and assured that we don't have any of that building? Or how will we know? How will you know?
Well, one of the things Governor Stein said is he didn't think at this point that things had, you know, were sort of out of control in financial markets. And for that reason, you know, and I also agree with that assessment. But this is something the Fed's watching much more closely than we would have in the past because of the experience over the last 5 years. And so we are trying to keep our eye on this. You know, things like land prices in the district here do concern me. And, you know, there are other parts of the financial markets that do concern me a little bit. But at this point, my overall assessment would be that we're still okay on this dimension.
Well, the Fed is operating in securities markets at the moment, and that can contaminate the market. And a lot of people are saying that it is contaminating the market, and that is going to be, you know, a price to pay for that. Do you agree?
Well, I think, you know, people often say this, but of course the Fed is part of the equilibrium in the financial market. So, you know, the Fed policy always has partly, you know, is intervening in financial markets. So, you know, the question is the equilibrium that we're creating, is that one that's going to get out of control in the future, or a lot of inflation in the future? I think we are taking some risk on that, or that will foster some financial market instability through the policies that we have now. And those are very live debates and things that I think everyone around the table is concerned about. But, you know, my assessment right now is that we've got it about right.
I want to ask you one of these more theoretical questions.
Great. I love theory.
I know you do. And you're way above my pay grade on this. But the Woodford period
Yes.
Expectations, he says basically expectations about what the Fed's going to do matter even more than the actual bond purchases that are done on some level. I mean, I'm oversimplifying perhaps, but if the whole point of the keeping the key rate at zero till mid-2015 or whatever is to have that expectation firmly set in financial, you know, the participants' minds that nothing's going to happen, and then you say, oh, well, actually, no, we're going to make this contingent on the economy too, haven't you suddenly watered down? Haven't you sort of muted the impact that is supposed to have on the real economy, the real outcome?
Yeah, Professor Woodford gave a famous speech at Jackson Hole in a paper at Jackson Hole last summer, and in it he divided the Fed's policy toolkit into two parts, the QE part and the forward guidance part. And he's a big advocate of forward guidance, and he thinks QE isn't very effective at all. I'm sort of on the other side of the fence on that. I think QE is pretty effective, and I think forward guidance is a bit dangerous because forward guidance says I'm going to not just stay at zero during the part where I'm where the economy's quite bad, but I'm going to stay at zero beyond that point, even as the economy begins to recover. But one problem with the promise to stay at zero is you can get this Japanese-type outcome where the markets just say, well, I think you're going to be at zero for a very long period of time. In Japan, it's been 15 years and counting. So it can backfire on you. It's kind of a double-edged sword. So for that reason, I like QE better than the forward guidance. By the way, we're the only central bank that's really experimented this extensively with forward guidance ideas. The other central banks, the Bank of England and the ECB, Bank of Japan, have not been willing to try to make these promises out there in the future. So I would say, just to the committee's credit and to the chairman's credit, that he's been willing. That's another dimension on where he's been willing to experiment with different types of policies at the period that we can't use our normal short-term.
Some might argue that the ECB's inflation target is superior to what you're doing because they have a target. They hit it. It's completely predictable. They've managed to stay very close to their target, and they are therefore then giving sort of the ultimate guidance to the economy and to the markets.
I would say, you know, we've also been fairly successful in staying close to our inflation target. Might matter a little bit exactly which measure of inflation you use, but we've been pretty successful overall on that dimension. And in particular, inflation has not sunk down to zero or into negative territory for very long. We've been able to keep it up near the stated inflation target. I think that's been a success of our policy. Now, another thing that we did just within the last 15 months was actually set a formal inflation target. The U.S. didn't have that until recently. We only had an implicit target. So I think that was an important move and one that's going to pay dividends going forward.
Just on that, you know, you mentioned thresholds and it's not the same as triggers. You mentioned that back in February as well. Do you think that Fed policy is becoming maybe too complicated, too specific, and is confusing at least some market participants, if not even perhaps FOMC members at times?
Well, it is. Unfortunately, we are trying a lot of different things because it's extraordinary times and so we got a lot of moving parts to policy compared to what we would have in ordinary times when we can just talk about a short-term interest rate and movements in that interest rate. So I do worry about that, but I don't really think it can be helped in this kind of situation where we're trying to get a good monetary policy for the country, in times which are very unusual for monetary policy.
Stock market. It's been pretty clear that one of the objectives of the Fed's quantitative easing is to encourage investors to take more risk and to move into riskier assets. We have the Dow and the S&P back again at new highs. Did the Fed cause that? Is that QE in action?
Well, one of the things that you saw during the QE2 period, among many things, but one of the things that you saw was a rally in equity markets, and it was the same thing, I think, that's going on right now. Again, I think that the full-fledged QE2 type policy has only been in effect since December. It's not that the Fed is targeting equity markets. It's that that's a natural consequence of Fed easing. And so I think that's what's going on there.
So we have many people we interview on the show every day, Vonnie and I, who say, well, you know, we're convinced the Fed, until this economy is really going strong, the Fed, and seeing what the stock market is doing, the Fed is not going to pull back away from QE. When they look, the Fed won't even start tapering off. I mean, so are you concerned about what happens when the tapering off starts to the stock market?
Well, I'm not. I think we can play our cards correctly and make small moves in that are sensible in response to data coming in on the economy. So I think that we can play that in just the right way to taper down the program at the appropriate time. And then I don't think that will be a huge move in markets. I think the wrong way to play it would be that we don't do anything for a long time. Markets are concerned that they're not sure what we're going to do, and then all of a sudden one day we turn around and turn off the spigot. I think that would be a poor way to do it.
President Buller, though, what makes you so confident that you won't jolt the bond markets when you do begin to pull back, or even signal a pulling back on your purchases?
Well, if we're in good sync with markets, they'll have a good idea about the kinds of things we're thinking about, and I think shows like this are a good chance to try to exchange views on that. And so then I think it wouldn't be too much of a surprise the day that it actually happens.
Savers, President Bullard, savers have been radically hurt in the last 5 years. What would you say to them today?
Yeah, unfortunately, the current policy of zero rates has really damaged returns to savers, and this is an issue that I think is concerning, and it's something that's not in our typical macroeconomic models, or at least not very explicitly. And this is a group of people that consumes, so they've been cut back on their consumption. So in that sense, our policy might be a bit counterproductive. So I am concerned about this. I think if it was a more normal business cycle where you would keep rates low for a little while, a year or 18 months, that would make sense. But what's happening is that this is going on 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. And I think that that's damaging this group of savers. So I'm concerned about that.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
You can listen to The Hayes Advantage weekdays at 12:30 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.